dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the War of Ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. It is always a pleasure to have a chance to catch up with one of our colleagues. He is Dr. Luis Fleischmann, a man who has spent much of his life focused on and engaged in the public policy issues concerning Latin America. He has, among other things, written extensively for the Americas Report of the Center for Security Policy, Mengus Hemispheric Security Project. He's the author of Latin America in the Post-Chavez Era, The Threat to U.S. Security, from the Center for Security Policy Press. He is also an adjunct professor at Florida Atlantic University. Luis, welcome back. It's so good to have you.
Good to be here, Frank. A real pleasure.
I want to chat with you quickly, Luis, and we won't be able to do justice to this, I'm afraid, but this situation in Venezuela, which I have long thought couldn't possibly continue, is somehow managing to persist, specifically the regime of Nicolas Maduro, Hugo Chavez's hand-picked successor, who is destroyed the country, the economy, as well as most people's lives there, driven 4 million of them out of the country, yet he is still a going concern. How could that be?
Well, the reality is that the Venezuelan government is struggling to stay in power, and they are determined to stay in power, and they would do anything to stay in power. And they don't care about the legitimacy. They don't care about the success of the country. This is really a Cuban model. No matter what, they will persist to be in power. They have the military in their pockets. And not only that they have the military in their pockets, it's the military itself, you know, since they are, like every totalitarian state, is afraid of a military rebellion, right? That was Stalin, that was Hitler, that was Castro. They are spying on key military people also. That's the reason why the military is afraid basically to rebel. So I think it's going to take a long time until actually the regime is removed from power.
There's also these negotiations that are going on between the Maduro camp and the internationally recognized government of Venezuela, of Juan Guaido. What's going on there, and what do you see are the prospects for any kind of resolution as a result?
Well, these talks are basically just theater. In other words, Maduro is trying to gain time, and he expects people to forget about Venezuela, because that happened in the past. There have been already several uprisings, several mass protests, you know, a lot of noise, and then the entire thing was forgotten. This is why it's important for the United States to continue, and the international community to continue insisting on the issue of Venezuela. The Lima Group, which is the Latin American countries that are supporting the ousting of Nicolas Maduro, they're already somehow, not backing off, I would say, but they have lowered their profile. And I think that's what Maduro expects. These negotiations are not going to lead to any desirable result. You know, Maduro is eager and is determined to stay in power.
Yeah. Let me ask you about some changes in the firmament of the military and sort of security apparatus. Does that bespeak either increasing uncertainty on Maduro's part about the loyalty of those who serve in such agencies, despite, you know, the presence of the Cuban, you know, political czars or political operatives? Or is it simply a new effort to exercise further control of those vital entities?
Well, I think the Venezuelan government, the Venezuelan regime is aware that there is discontent among the military. This is why we heard today that two people loyal to Diosdado Cabello, one of them, his first cousin, has been appointed to be the chief of staff of the military, which, by the way, that reinforces the power that Diosdado Cabello actually has on this regime. Diosdado Cabello, just for the knowledge of the audience, is a major drug trafficker. He basically is the number one guy in the Venezuelan regime that operates the entire drug trafficking operation. I mean, it's a narco state, basically, and Cabello is the number one in that narco state. And there is another guy that was also appointed chief of the National Guard. That basically is in order to reinforce the regime's control on the military. Besides the fact that the military is under surveillance of Cuban elements and others. You know, the military now is under strict control and they are afraid of the military. There is no question that the regime is afraid of the military. And I think the best example is the murder and torture of Capitan Acosta. That was really a display. You know, Capitan Acosta is a guy that was arrested, tortured and murdered by the government last week. And that was a way to send a message to the military that whoever even thinks of rebelling or do something against the regime will pay a very expensive price.
Yeah, and he was a military officer?
Was a military officer, Capitan Acosta, accused of treason and all kinds of things.
Yeah, yeah. Let me ask you, speaking of these sorts of extreme measures, there are also reports, Luis Fleischman, that the Maduro government is behind death squads that are now operating in the country, something that has previously been characterized as a hallmark of right-wing governments, but here you have one in the left. I think they're called special action teams or something like that. Tell us about that. What do you know?
Yes, well, these death squads obviously now is part of a policy of the regime to carry out extrajudicial killings, which, by the way, the recent United Nations report actually denounced that. The regime always used what is called paramilitary forces to repress the colectivos, which is a bunch of criminals. My guess is that there are also former members of the FARC. Probably there are people from Hezbollah involved, and certainly a lot of criminals that have been released from prison in order precisely to become one of these paramilitary groups to repress demonstrations. And now these death squads, what they are doing is basically extrajudicial killings. And we assume that they are going to do it also with military people who actually, members of the military who actually are dissenters. In other words, what we are seeing here is a totalitarian regime, basically.
Cracking down using terror and violence. These special action forces, as they're called, are not to be underestimated as a new instrument of the oppression of the people of Venezuela. And I believe the United States government, President Trump and Ambassador John Bolton are absolutely right to be doing everything they can to try to bring this horrific regime to an end as soon as possible. Luis Fleischman, we have to leave it at that. We look forward to talking with you again soon, sir. Thank you so much, Luis. Good to talk with you, my friend.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. It's a delight to say we have one of my all-time favorite friends and longtime colleagues with us. His name is Dr. Henry Cooper. He has served in, well, more capacities than you can shake a stick at in our government, in the United States Air Force as a uniformed officer, as a civilian member of its management, as a senior official in the late and unlamented Arms Control and Disarmament Agency. He was President Reagan's Space and Defense Talks ambassador. He went on to become George Herbert Walker Bush's director of the Strategic Defense Initiative Organization, a man of extraordinary ability and knowledge and, well, service to our country. And I'm so grateful to him for his friendship as well as all of that good work. Henry Cooper, welcome back, sir. It's so good to have you with us. How are you?
I'm doing fine down here in South Carolina. Glad to be with you.
God's country. It's good to have you. Listen, I wanted to talk to you about a couple of things related to that last portfolio and one that you continue to work on as the chairman of a great group, High Frontier, namely missile defense, Hank. There's been a lot of, well, I guess in Star Wars, they would call it perturbations in the force. Star Wars being one of the things that was, of course, taken out of the missile defense business by Les Aspin shortly after you left office. There have been reasons to believe that our present missile defense systems are not up to the job, perhaps even the job before the advent of hypersonic missile technologies, but certainly now that they're being introduced by both the Russians and Chinese and presumably in short order others among their clientele. What is the state, as you see it, of our current missile defense capability, and what do we need to be doing instead?
Well, you've hooked a number of important things together, Frank. First observation I'd make is that, as you noted, Les Aspin took the stars out of Star Wars, as he said, in 1993, and basically killed off the most important products of the Reagan SDI era, which was between 1983 and 93. And basically killed the most important technology programs that I was pursuing at the time, including one that was Bryant Pebbles, the space-based interceptor system, which has remained dormant ever since. And I'm very hopeful that the private sector now, Elon Musk in particular, with his SpaceX activities with small satellites in low Earth orbit, are going to provide the technology again to revive that capability in the near future. If we do that, we'll be on the path to most effective cost, least costly way to defend the country. Because of the decisions made in 93 and have not been reversed, we have spent most of our money on the least effective, most costly ways to defend against ballistic missile attack. And that needs to change, and the technology is the root of that change, ultimately. And frankly, I'm pleased with Elon Musk's effort and others who are pursuing technology that will enable us to once again build the most cost-effective defenses. But frankly, the ground-based interceptor program that we have spent most of our money on to defend the United States, first of all, has a limited number of interceptors, and secondly, doesn't get around to intercepting anything until they're well on their way and almost to their targets in the United States or wherever they may be. And we need, most of all, the ability to intercept things in their boost phase while they're still rising. That would enable us to defeat the nearest term hypersonic threat, which is now the item in vogue and all the discussions of the evolving capabilities, particularly of Russia and China. Russia now claims to have deployed or will be deploying Avangard, which is a boost glide intercept system. And if we could shoot it down on its way up, we'd completely negate that system. So we now are on the edge of reviving the technologies now advanced by three decades that we were pursuing at the cutting edge of the SDI era. And so I'm hopeful if we have the time that we're going to see most cost-effective technologies employed to defend us in the near future.
Well, boy, you just said the key words, if we have the time. The trouble with all of this is that at the same time as our present missile defense systems are seemingly increasingly inadequate and the developments that you're talking about loom, but they're still presumably some ways off from being realized. Our nuclear deterrent is leaving a lot to be desired, Hank, and you've spent much of your professional career working that part of the portfolio as well. And I just would ask you, You doubtless heard President Trump saying that in his conversations with Vladimir Putin in Osaka, Japan recently, that they had, I guess, favorably considered Putin's suggestion that they have new arms control arrangements, perhaps including the Chinese, that would cap the existing forces. And Hank, when you look at what the Soviets, or now Russians, have been doing massively to modernize their forces and the current state of ours, what would a, well, nuclear freeze, for want of a better expression, perhaps, do in terms of our deterrent capabilities?
Well, that's a very good term. As you know, that term of art was employed in the 70s and 80s when we worked together to defeat it, including, you know, the bishops and so on of the Catholic Church, who came out widely in opposition to this, and many members of Congress who opposed Reagan's efforts to revive sensible defenses, and even more importantly, in my judgment earlier, to move on with the INF agreement, the Intermediate Nuclear Forces Agreement, which we've raised the issue that we were leaving, and the Russians have withdrawn now as well. As you know, I was in the room when Reagan and Gorbachev signed that in Washington, and also when he signed the ratified version in Moscow. So I've been associated with this problem. But the notable thing is that we wouldn't have had that agreement, that arms control agreement, without the buildup of our strategic nuclear forces, the modernization program, so-called Reagan's modernization program, when he basically withdrew from the talks, in spite of all this political noise about what the Russians were doing and the arms control community being up in arms and the freeze movement and the Congress and so on, and insisted on modernizing our strategic forces, which had atrophied during the Carter years in particular. And but it went back well before then, as you say, when I was working on MX and other programs. And it was because of Reagan's insistence on doing the right thing so that we could negotiate from strength, a position of strength, that led to the arms control agreement. In a real sense, we're in a period of deja vu. You know, all over again, we're doing the, as Yogi Berra said it, reliving the 70s and the Carter era, when we were negotiating agreements that didn't amount to a hole of beans, that only legitimized the buildup, particularly by the Soviet Union, whereas we were sitting on our hands. And now we're doing the same thing again, and the arms control community is raising the same kind of ruckus as an obstacle to modernizing our strategic forces again. Trump is just right, and I hope he stays the course that he's on, insisting on the improvements of our capabilities and resisting the siren call of arms control, while building up our nuclear forces and strengthening our defenses, ballistic missile defenses in particular. That's a way to counterbalance the INF improvements that Russia is going through, as well as what we did back then, which was deploy our own INF missiles, enabling the Aegis Ashore sites that are deployed in Romania and Poland to assure that they can defeat the Soviet INF missiles that they now say they're going to build, is an alternate to building a new INF set of systems in this country, although I wouldn't argue against that repeat as well. So in my sense of it is, we're seeing again the era in which you and I first worked together in the Reagan, I'll call it, revolution, which led to ultimately to sound arms control agreements that we insisted upon verifying with confidence, trust but verify, Reagan said. And I believe that Trump is on that same wavelength now.
Well, two quick points, Hank. One, you remember very well, speaking of the old days, a secretary I believe you served under, Dr. Harold Brown, the Secretary of the Air Force, and then ultimately the Secretary of Defense under Jimmy Carter. And Harold Brown famously quipped at one point about the so-called arms race, that when we build, the Soviets build, and when we stop building, the Soviets keep building. And there is this sort of deja vu aspect to that. You're absolutely right. But I just have to say, I must recall that I was one of those who was a little less sanguine about the verifiability of the INF treaty at the end of the day, and not at all surprised that we find ourselves in a situation today where it's been cheated on by the Russians, even though a considerable effort was made to have it be more sound than it would otherwise have been, certainly under left to the tender mercies of all the arms controllers. Hank, lastly, let me just say, you have been doing incalculably important work. We won't have time to discuss it in any detail today, but I think your leadership on the effort to try to protect our country's most critical of critical infrastructures, our electric grid, against the threats of electromagnetic pulse and other forms of attack is perhaps your most signal contribution to our national security. And that's really saying something when you look back on your, whatever it's been now, 40 or 50 or 60 years maybe of service to our country. And I want to get you back on at some point soon to talk about what you've been doing down in South Carolina and North Carolina and the ways in which we can really move forward to implement the president's very important executive order on protecting the grid. But that's for another day. For today, let me simply say thank you. Come back to us again very soon.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back. I'm pleased to say, joined by retired United States Air Force Colonel Dan Gallington. Dan is a man who has served his country not only in uniform, but in a whole host of civilian capacities as well. We worked together a lifetime ago in the office of the Secretary of Defense when he was working on arms control issues alongside our previous guest, Hank Cooper. We were also the beneficiaries of his service at the Department of Justice and as the last bipartisan general counsel for the U.S. Senate Select Committee on Intelligence. These days, he's a professor at the University of Illinois Law School, where he teaches, thank God, national security law. It's nice to know somebody still thinks there is such a thing. Certainly not the Democrats at the moment. Dan, welcome back. It's good to have you with us.
Well, I'm glad to be back, Frank. It's always a treat to do this. And you talked to Hank Cooper today. Did Hank remember all those times that he and I used to beat on each other over in Geneva?
I had the discretion not to mention that we were going to be talking to you afterwards. I think he still holds grudges. We're Irish, after all.
Absolutely.
I remember well some of the difficulties I had with him as well. But all that's with bygones is bygones. Dan, let's talk about what's going on at the moment. You have, of course, spent a lot of time in DOD, at DOJ, on Capitol Hill, at NSA, working on the intelligence portfolio and its strengths and its very significant shortcomings. I was struck by a reorganization that has just taken place, and I wanted to ask you about it and sort of tease out from the immediate topic, some larger questions as well. The reorganization involves how background investigations, among other things, are handled. It's been taken away from the hapless Office of Personnel Management, which last check lost, evidently, to Chinese intelligence, millions of files of individuals like thee and me and people with a lot more interesting jobs, notably in the clandestine services and the like. A catastrophe, I think it's fair to say, for counterintelligence. So a new agency has been stood up in the Defense Department called the Counterintelligence and Security Agency, which will be headed up by a longtime intelligence professional, Charles Phelan. Tell us what's going on in this specific regard, and then more generally, if you would, sort of the state of our counterintelligence.
Well, you know, there's, as you alluded to, it's a rich history here. If you're a fan of watching the TV series The Americans, and I know many people are, you have sort of a look back into the 1980s about how the Soviets focused on collecting information about people in and around Washington, D.C. And interestingly enough, during those days, the focus of the Russians was on information-intensive agencies and organizations part of our private sector. We found Russian spies, for example, in working for insurance companies and working for state automobile registrations and working in data intensive areas. Well, the Chinese essentially took that a step further and did a penetration of OPM, the historical keeper of your SF-86 and my SF-86.
Those are our personnel files.
Exactly. And this is the form you fill out that's your life history that is used to determine whether or not you should get a clearance or not, and if so, what kind. And as we're talking right now, the Chinese are probably studying our SF-86s.
Could well be. Yours is more interesting than mine, needless to say.
Well, you know, I doubt that. I doubt that. But the point is, when they look at mine, they know whether or not I have any Chinese relatives, any contacts with China. They know, for example, that I was stationed in Taiwan and from 73 to 75 during the action years there. And a matter of fact, when I was working in Geneva, I was approached by a quote, Chinese diplomat who asked me about that. And I thought, now, how the hell did you know that I was in Taiwan in those years?
That's before they got their hands on your OPM file, needless to say. But Dan Gallington, here's the thing. Is this likely to be handled better at the Defense Department, in your experience? Is counterintelligence as a mission area taken any more seriously there than any place else in the U.S.?
I think the answer is a qualified yes. Now, the problem with OPM's background problem was they contracted it out. And I think that that demonstrated the weakness of that approach to it. I remember having an agent stop by and asking me some questions about some people I knew. And it was clear that he/she was a rookie and really didn't know what they were doing, and they were contractor employees.
He/she meaning they were transgender?
Because I know it's inappropriate to say he or she anymore. So, but the person was clearly a rookie and didn't really understand what they were doing. I assume that the whole idea for this new agency is to stop that contractor focus and to use more professional people to do background investigations and I assume the rules have been changed to allow deeper penetrations of background investigations. In other words, can you go on the internet and put in Frank Gaffney's name or Dan Gallington's name and see what's there?
Well, it's just unbelievable that that wouldn't have been done before now, though I must tell you, most of what's there on my account is misleading, to say the least. But Dan, let me just ask you, one of the aspects of that contractor problem I remember vividly was an outfit, I recall it was U.S. Intelligence Services or something like that. And it was one of the contractors that was found to have, quote, flushed, unquote, 600,000 background investigations, which means they claimed they had done them and they just hadn't. And yet people presumably nonetheless got clearances and were able to get jobs in the government. And heavens only knows what kind of counterintelligence vulnerabilities we have as a result of that. But let me turn to one other piece of this, because Breitbart today had a article on its website featuring a study that was recently conducted into, a poor man's version of the Chinese theft of OPM data. Evidently, somebody got their hands on files of something like 200 or 300 million Chinese curricula vitae, they call them, bios. Not the kind of detailed information that you would have on, you know, one of our personnel forms, needless to say, Dan, but some interesting information nonetheless. And one of the things that the study determined was, looking at a tiny subset of that universe of Chinese nationals, they found 25,000 who worked for Huawei, this Chinese conglomerate. We spend a lot of time talking about Huawei on this program because it's such a huge problem, as you know, Dan. And they determined that of those 25,000, a non-trivial number, I think it was 100 or so, actually had been simultaneously, according to their CVs, working for Huawei in some capacity or other, and working for the Ministry of State Security or the People's Liberation Army or Chinese intelligence or the Chinese Communist Party or something. So making clear, in other words, that there is a tie between Huawei and the security services of China, as has been claimed by the U.S. government and widely denied by Huawei, the Chinese, and unfortunately, many of our European allies who now are relying on Huawei technology. What are the implications of all of that, Dan, as you see it?
Well, you know, I mean, think about that creatively, though, for a minute. It's essentially like all the mobile users and all the mobile companies here in this country having being part ownership with NSA. It's the same concept as that. There would be no wall between the operations, and that's clear that that's what they have in China. Well, they always have had that. I mean, when you talk to, you're on the phone in China talking to somebody, or you're talking to somebody in China. I mean, somebody's listening, and somebody is taking notes, and somebody is essentially using that network for both internal control of their own people and also to collect intelligence throughout the world. And they have back doors. You know they have back doors into most of the systems they sell. That's the reason they're so cheap. And the irony of this is that the systems they sell, for the most part, are copies of systems designed and protected with U.S. patent and intellectual property rights here, but just blatantly stolen by the Chinese.
No accident, comrade, as they say. Hey, Dan, our friend and colleague Bill Gertz had a piece in the Washington Free Beacon yesterday, I believe, about ZTE, one of these other companies, having gotten tagged with spying in Silicon Valley and helping the People's Liberation Army steal U.S. technology. And I'm reminded that, speaking of Huawei, President Trump had last year, as a favor to Xi Jinping, essentially gave a get-out-of-jail-free card to ZTE that enabled the company to get back on its feet and do this kind of thing. I assume you agree with me that it would be most ill-advised for the president to give any waivers to this other outfit, Huawei, to enable it to continue doing business with American companies at a moment like this.
Yeah, the hard part of that, and I agree with you, Frank, but the hard part of that is how do you define that? Because they're, you know, they're everywhere.
Well, I'd just say quickly, not nowhere, not know how. Don't have anything to do with them. We have to leave it at that, I'm afraid. We are hard out of time. I did want to say thank you for bringing up the Americans, because I actually had a small 15 seconds of fame in the course of one of their programs where Cap Weinberger and I were given a plaudit, I think, for holding the line for President Reagan. Anyway, those were the good old days. Dan, I appreciated sharing them with you and sharing so many of your insights today. Thank you for joining us. Come back to us again, if you would, very soon. Next up, Jim Simpson. We'll talk about the Red-Green Axis 2.0 right after this.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back, joined by my friend Jim Simpson. He is an investigative journalist, a former official in the Office of Management and Budget at the White House, the author of several extremely important books and countless articles. The first that I'm particularly proud of is The Red-Green Axis, Refugees, Immigration, and the Agenda to Erase America, that he published with the Center for Security Policy Press in 2015. He is also the author of the brand new book, the sequel, if you will, The Red-Green Axis 2.0, An Existential Threat to America and the World. Jim Simpson, it's good to have you back. Welcome.
Frank, great to be with you again.
Well, congratulations on the new book from the Center for Security Policy Press. I wanted to give you a chance to talk a little bit about the book, and specifically, Jim, just explain what's meant by this term, red-green axis, And what gives rise to your concern about an agenda to, as you put it in the first one, erase our country?
The red-green axis is the alliance between the Marxist left in the United States and actually overseas as well, and all the various Muslim organizations that are together working aggressively to undermine every aspect of our society. As you well know, for example, the Council on American Islamic Relations has broken the bank in an effort to silence its critics. And as we know, that organization is not a social welfare organization. It is a malevolent, terrorist-tied organization, along with the rest of the Muslim Brotherhood groups in this country, of which there are more than most people even can contemplate, working daily to undermine our laws, suing relentlessly, and joining with the radical left, for example, Black Lives Matter, in protests against our society. The goal of this alliance is to take down our country. And a big component of that agenda is the entire immigration program, which includes the refugee resettlement program, asylum, the open borders agenda, and even many aspects of legal immigration, which I discuss at great length in this book, because the entire thing is designed to bring in so many people from so many diverse cultures that the American tradition, the people who understand and support our American experiment, the thing that has been the most successful thing in the world and draws people and inspires people around the world, they're trying to just make us an irrelevancy by bringing in people from all over the world that don't even understand, let alone agree with, the founding principles of our nation.
This is, of course, troubling news. In the interest of full disclosure, Jim, I think it's fair to say both you and I have been savaged by the Council on American Islamic Relations and the Southern Poverty Law Center rather relentlessly for the purpose, as you say, of silencing us, suppressing the kind of well-documented, vitally needed information that we provide, whether it's in programs like this or books like yours or the various other products of our team, the Center for Security Policy most especially. So for listeners to this program, I don't think it's going to be terribly surprising that there are these forces at work. We try to relentlessly report on them despite the suppression. But I did want to just ask you, how is this manifesting itself in the Congress of the United States at the moment? It seems that there's a sort of person who, in a way, personifies the red-green axis by the name of Representative Ilhan Omar of Minnesota. And Jim, I know you've studied closely her rise to her current station and her associations and her rhetorical broadsides against, well, Israel and, for that matter, the United States. Talk us through how she does indeed sort of represent both strands of this red-green phenomenon.
Well, you know, she and her fellow Muslim Congresswoman Rashida Tlaib, they are both directly connected to the extreme left, the Democratic Socialists of America, who are not democratic in any sense of the word. And they're not even socialists. The DSA is derived from the a Maoist movement. It's a communist organization. But she and Rashida both are heavily involved in the left, and they are compulsively anti-American, anti-Israel, anti-Semitic. And Ilhan Omar, perhaps it personifies that profile more than anybody else in the U.S. Congress. I think she's actually deliberate agitator.
Provocateur.
Exactly.
And to what end, Jim? Because you would think that if you've managed to penetrate the United States Congress and you have an opportunity to serve on, well, among other things, the House Foreign Affairs Committee, that you could advance your agenda much more effectively by sort of the classic Muslim Brotherhood technique of stealthy jihad, civilization jihad, as they call it. She's out there, you know, calling attention to herself, definitely encouraging people to challenge her. What's up with that? And is it, in whatever her motivation, is it actually working for her as you see it?
Well, that's a good question as to whether or not it's working. I do believe that she, and she's no different in that sense from Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez or Rashida Tlaib. I believe that their role is to be provocateurs and to actually, because the effort to silence us is so omnipresent today and so aggressive, I believe that she in particular is out there just being as blatant as she can, because the reaction, people's reaction, for example, in Minnesota, there was recently a New York Times reporter, quote unquote, traveled to Minnesota to investigate it. And what they actually investigated, they didn't investigate.
Investigate what?
Well, to look into Minnesota and to see what the culture was doing there, what all the controversies were about. I mean, this is the ostensible reason. But of course, what came out of it was that this New York Times reporter attacked anybody and everybody who criticized Ilhan Omar, who criticized the new Attorney General Keith Ellison.
Another member of the Red-Green Axis, it must be said.
Exactly. Yes. All the people on the left in the Muslim Brotherhood universe who are literally turning Minnesota upside down. But instead of focusing, for example, he could have very easily focused on Ilhan Omar's immigration fraud, where she married her own brother to get him into this country and to get student loans. And there are so many things that she has done illegally here. She would be ripe for investigation from a truly investigative journalist. But this guy's sole purpose was to attack and vilify those who had criticized Omar, who had criticized Keith Ellison, and who were raising the alarm bells about what is going on in Minnesota.
So this is an adjunct to the Red-Green Axis that is greatly enabling it and advancing its agenda of erasing America, because it is contributing to suppressing those of us who are raising the alarm about it. I know they won't suppress you successfully, Jim Simpson. Thank God you are indefatigable, and your work with us at the Center for Security Policy and more generally is deeply appreciated. I hope join us again soon. We're going to do a longer drill down on all of this. And I hope the rest of you will come back to us again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Affney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.